Our final speaker today is one you're all very familiar with. He's frank, blunt, straight to the point. He says it as it is, and he spares no one in the way he makes it very clear. And interestingly, all of our discussions today have looked at security in a way that you probably have thought never thought about before. It's been multidimensional, and it's been, you know, a trickle down to how it exactly affects you, rather than guns and bullets and all of those sort of things. Like Ruthmi will say, you cannot bomb poverty away. So Ruthmi Sankore is a journalist, a development and policy expert, and he's worked as a journalist across Africa and internationally, and until recently was the editorial board chair of Nigeria Info Radio Group. Some of his previous journalism, development and rights work include being founding editor-in-chief of Africa Development Information, which pioneered the use of data for journalism and policy advocacy during the Millennium Development Goals between 2000 and 2015. Pioneer editor in the mid to late 90s of the Belgium-based International Federation of Journalists, a website for African journalists reporting on public accountability, corruption, democracy, and rights-related issue. He's worked with Tempo, the news, of a few who remembered guerrilla journalism back in those days in the military era. Some of the people who were behind all the great work that happened when we had to sneak to get to read what was happening in our dear own country. His recent work, global and global Africa-wide development work, include consultancy and project lead on partnership projects with the UNFPA, UNAIDS, WHO, Africa Development Bank, and the African Union. He's also coordinated Africa 15% Plus campaign with development and health financing, which was chaired by South African democracy and rights advocate, Nobel Peace Prize laureate, Archbishop Desmond Tutu. With all gratitude, and thank you very much, Ruthmi Sankore, as we welcome our final speaker on the Nigeria Info Summit, Nigeria Info Security Summit. A round of applause again for Ruthmi Sankore.
Hello, everyone. Thank you for sparing time to join us for this really important discussion. So I always say to people that there is almost nothing that you cannot explain with demographics and data. In fact, it can guide you. You can see forward 50 years. You can look back 50 years to predict the behavior of individuals, but you can predict how societies will turn out by looking at demographics and data. And I just want to use just two maps. I could have 50, but I just want to use two to demonstrate how a lot of things happening in Nigeria could have been well anticipated. So, if you look at this, about 6 years ago, when the Boko Haram insurgency was peaking, I sat down with some of my colleagues working with, you know, data statistics and things, and I was like, you know, let's try and understand this thing better and see where it could go. And by the way, this is official government data. It's not our data, because I always do two things. I work with the MBS data, the population data, the state government data, and then we do our own analysis to see how close they are. And you can see where in the northeast, where the Boko Haram insurgency was highest. I mean, where extremism is highest, to put it more specifically, because it could change from Boko Haram to ISWAP very quickly. So let's just say extremism. Let's not use brand names. And we looked at the northeast there. the percentage of males that had had zero access to education, not even primary school, 52.4%. What did they think was going to happen there if extremism sprinkled in? At that time, the focus was on Northeast. I spoke at two places. I said, the federal government and the state government, their eye is off the ball because the Northwest is coming. And as you can see, 46.9%. This map alone can explain a lot of things to you. There is another more detailed map, state by state. And that map would show you that at this time in Borno State, the percentage of males that had had zero access to education was 83% in Yobe State and 63% in Borno State. So in other words, in the core areas extremism was picking up, only 27% and 17% of males had access to even primary education. So you can see the issue is developmental. There is no amount of Tucano aircraft that you are going to take there that will solve this problem. So I always say, no army on this planet has ever defeated underdevelopment. It's not going to start in Nigeria. The next one, please. By the way, if you look at Lagos or Southwest, you will see that it's not immune. But if you factor in that the population of Lagos is 20 million, for instance, you know, which kind of weights the Southwest, you will understand where all those agboros are coming from. Yeah, because look, 10% of 20 million gives you a higher absolute number than 50% 4 million. So the density of the problem, except of course that most of them can attach themselves to the transport sector as agbero. Without the transport sector in Lagos, those are all potential bandits. So, we wanted to drill down. So, this gives you the context. So, when you hear now that 8,000 extremists surrendered, pay attention. Look at the numbers. So, you see, Yobe, 83% males, no education. Estimated male population at the time, 1.4 million. You don't have to be a genius to know that there are effectively tens of thousands of potential recruits for extremists there. Look at Borno State. Estimated male population, 2.5 million. 63% of them, zero access to education. So, 8,000 surrendered. What? And by the way, the 8,000 that surrendered still don't have any education. So, but that is Northeast. Pay attention to the other side. You can see Kebbi, Sokoto, Zamfara, Katsina. Tell me at that time that I did not know there would be a banditry problem in 2015. The data is telling us already where the problem is going. And it's getting worse. It will get worse. Why? Because about 7.5 million children are born in Nigeria every year. And guess what? The majority of them are born there. If the banditry is highest in Kato, Captain Aliyu showed us a hunger map of Nigeria. Do you know what was driving that hunger? Population growth. Zamfara used to have the highest hunger and malnutrition in the country until about 3 years ago when Katsina overtook it. In Katsina, the hunger and malnutrition is about 53%. Why is it that high? Katsina has the highest total fertility rate in the country. Almost 8 children are born to each woman in Katsina. And guess what? Katsina also has the highest polygamy rate. So if you are thinking that a fertility rate of about 8 per woman is high, multiply by 4. Yes. So more than half the men in Katsina have 32 children. Tell me why there won't be hunger and malnutrition there. Katsina has the highest average class size in the country. 100 children per class. Katsina also has the lowest age. Katsina also has the lowest age. Are initiated into sexual activity and forced pregnancy, 13 to 14 years. They have, remember that fertility rate I mentioned is average. Individually, the girls could have 11 or 12 children each. So, yeah. So when the governors of Katsina and Zamfara are negotiating with bandits, they are negotiating with demographic issues, failed planning. In the case of the governor of Zamfara State, I think he's even one of the worst culprits because he was the commissioner for youth, commissioner for rural development, commissioner for local government. The bandits he's negotiating with are a manifestation of his failure as a policymaker. And people are telling us that they are looking for the sponsors of bandits. You can't sponsor something that does not exist. So I just wanted to use this just to set the scene and take us back. By the way, if you see today's data, you will be frightened for the next 5 years. So okay. So if you listen to yesterday's program, you would have noted two things. Yesterday's public square. And these things are important for developmental planning and for security. I always say, when you hear, say, the Minister of Defense or top security people speaking, it's as if they don't have sociologists working in the security sector. It's as if they are just focusing on regime security, not the real security of the country. So, global data from the UNDP, not our MBS this time, tells us, this is country by country study, by the way, over 2 years, that there are 93 million Nigerians living in multidimensional poverty. 93 million, more or less half the country. Okay, so multidimensional poverty means it's not just the income in your pocket. It means you are in health poverty, education poverty, income poverty, energy poverty, water poverty, and so forth. Because as I was explaining on yesterday's program, if you look at countries where poverty has been addressed, it is sector by sector. So in most of Europe, for instance, children under 16 do not pay for public transport. They don't pay for train or bus. In some countries, it's only when you are going to school. But in some countries, it's 7 days a week at any time. If you're under 16, you don't pay for public transport. Pensioners do not pay for public transport. And so you can see how the energy, how the poverty is reduced. It's going to be winter now. Pensioners are going to have their energy subsidized. The education is free, primary and secondary. And you get loans. If you could, if you $200,000 a year till you finish uni, you'd be delighted. President Obama finished paying the loan he used to go to Harvard when he was president. So those are the ways that you reduce. So if you look at the ways in which demography impacts on development and security, you start to note certain patterns there. Education, access to education, access to skills, access to jobs, infrastructure or lack of it, inequality. Anywhere the inequality is, it is inevitable, including gender. And told us, when the president read his budget speech and told us that security is his priority. I've not read it line by line, but guess what? Those who have told me that there was no budget for family planning. Does the government understand that underdevelopment is tied and is the major cause of insecurity? Do the governors understand it? Obviously, they don't. So I always tell everybody that the major cause of insecurity and instability is underdevelopment. Unless you fix it, everything is mumbo jumbo. You are just wasting everybody's time. Whether you are the president or you are governors, and governors especially. Because guess what? In Nigeria, people pay too much attention to the federal government. The federal government, it is not their responsibility to build primary schools. It's not President Buhari's job to build primary schools. There are unity schools, but it is not his job. It is the job of local governments and state governments. So we need to be able to scale and understand where these problems start from, because countries fail community by community, local government by local government. And that is why in Yobe and Borno states, why did they fail first? Because a cluster of local governments failed. Why have Katsina and Zamfara states failed? Because clusters of communities and local governments failed. Why is Niger threat now in northeast and northwest Niger? And by the way, it's spreading. Niger, Kaduna, Abuja is not far away. We took the data back 12 years. 12 years ago, there were an estimated 4.4 million children out of school in Northwest Nigeria, just under 3 million in Northeast. You know, today, it's about 13 million children out of school. The government says it is 10 million, that they reduced it by 3 million in the year of COVID, when no child went to school and no school was built. If you believe that, I feel sorry for you. So, if you match the population growth with the number of out-of-school children as a percentage of the population, in about 10 years from now, we will have over 20 million children out of school. The Minister of Education tells us that we have 60 million Nigerians unable to read or write. That's what he tells us. I think it's at least 10 million more. Yes. By the way, 60 million is just a little under the population of UK or France. That is the weight the Nigerian economy has to carry of people that can't read or write. What do we think is going to happen? Every additional year of education that anybody has increases their income potential by 8 to 10%. Tell me the place that is going to suffer the most poverty. That's where the insecurity is coming from. Two-thirds of the communities globally, not just in Nigeria, that are in poverty, do not have a single woman that has done 6 years of education. With the concentrations in Nigeria, do the state governments understand the importance of gender equality, of girl child education? The governors appointing Hisba and hoping that Hisba will become the foundation of state police. What is the philosophical difference between Hisba, Boko Haram, and ISWAP? What? What is the difference between them and people like Governor Yerima that got himself a 13-year-old girl? There is no philosophical difference. The main difference between them, essentially, is that the extremist groups believe in the most backward forms of feudalism, which they try and confuse with religion. Why do I say they are confusing it with religion? Because there are parts of the world that share the same religion that are not as backward. All of them go to Dubai. Qatar is going to host the World Cup next year. By the way, it's a feudal country. They are just trying to introduce something that looks like a parliament. But guess what? Qatar is 2.9 million people. It's the same population as Ali Mashal local government. Ask me how many megawatts of electricity they have. 10,000 megawatts. 10,000 megawatts for 2.9 million people. We are 206 million, we are struggling with 5,000. Where is going to be more developed? Where is going to be more peaceful? Nigeria has a 95% power energy deficit. Why? Because according to global sustainable development standards, you need 1,000 megawatts per 1 million people. So we should be at 200,000. We are at 5,000. Sometimes it is 2,000. When the grid collapses, it is zero. So, it brings me to something that may happen or may not happen, depending on how the government responds. It's the anniversary of NSARS. There's a lot of tension in Lagos. Are the young people going to protest? Will it turn violent? The vice president is begging them, express it in another way. The security operatives, you know, are apprehensive and so forth, with good reason. Could all those things have been avoided? Yes. Yes. How? If the power generation in Nigeria is decentralized, Lagos can generate 20,000 megawatts. Remember, it's 33% unemployment in Nigeria. It is 22% underemployment. Combined, that is 55%. Now, in a city, because Lagos is a city, it's a state, but it is a city. The size, very small. Look at it at the bottom of the map there. It's very small. 10 of Lagos can fit into Niger State. 20 million people, that level of unemployment, that level of underemployment, and then you allowed a rogue section of your police to spend years robbing young people. Robbing them. Sometimes at gunpoint. Sometimes they march them to the ATM. Why? Because Lagos has more economic opportunity. More hustling opportunity. We have ports. We have an international airport. We have more industry. Any government paying attention to the demographics and seeing the trend of the NSARS could have called the head of SARS, the commissioner of police, and said, listen, guys, sooner or later, you are going to have a mass protest in Lagos. Sooner or later, if you keep putting pressure on young people, especially young people with phones and gadgets, which meant almost every young person. So it could have been avoided. They pretended the problem did not happen. The problem did not exist until it exploded into protests. And guess what? We all know that the protests were peaceful initially because people had demands that they were articulating. Globally, anywhere protests turn violent, it is almost always because the protesters have been attacked by deadly force. And then anarchy ensues. And even when anarchy ensues, it is not the protesters that are profiting from the anarchy. Who are the people profiting from it? No. The people at the bottom of the society. The underemployed. For some of those 93 million living in poverty. Because if you have not eaten more than once for several years and you have nothing and you have no hope and there is anarchy, did we not see the videos of the young women running into carrying babies, running out with pampers? What did we think was happening? Do you think those are hardened criminals? So these are things we need to pay attention to. So if the young people are going to protest this next week on the 20th, the developmental advice to the security forces will be, let them protest peacefully. If anything at all, you protect the protests. If you attack the protest violently and anarchy ensues, and everybody starts running helter-skelter, policemen are shooting at people in the back when they are running, what do you think is going to happen in a densely populated city like Lagos? It's basic sociology. It's sociology 101. Please, I'll say it a few minutes. Herder farmer conflict. That one is the easiest to solve in this country. So, herder farmer conflict is not unique to Nigeria. Herder farmer conflict happened in America, Argentina, Mexico, you just name it, 100 years ago. And how did they solve it? Two things. One, the cattle were no longer allowed to move on foot. They moved by train or in customized lorries. Two, they were put in ranches. Those cowboys we see in Western films, those were, yeah, that's what they were. And we know that when they moved cattle across Texas or Kansas or wherever, and the farmers harmed the cattle while protecting their farms, the cowboys would come back and burn the communities down. And it was resolved simply by stopping the movement of the cattle on foot, and more importantly, ranching them. So if you take Lagos, 20 million people, let's compare with a favorite country everybody wants to go to, Canada. Canada is 37 million people. The GDP contribution of milk from ranches to the Canadian economy is about $16 million a year. In Nigeria, we spend about 900 billion naira a year importing milk and cheese from countries that have ranches. Denmark, Dano milk is coming from ranches in Denmark, where the cattle are like small elephants. So, if Lagos had 4 ranches owned by anybody that is able to invest, the person could be Igbo, Yoruba, Hausa, whatever. You have one in Badagry, you have one in Ikorodu, you have one in Ekpe. I mean, that's where the land is. You can't put ranches in the middle of town. So, you put the cattle ranches there. Who in their right senses is going Lagos? Who? Yeah. Just by 3 ranches in Lagos, that's the end of that problem. Incredible opportunity for jobs. Tens of thousands of jobs. The American guy has left. I wanted to ask him so that he could confirm. A ranch hand in America, say like in Texas, where there is a lot of cattle, that has the equivalent of diploma, earns $19,000 to $21,000 a year. Why can't that be done in Lagos? The deputy governor of Lagos studied agriculture. Yes. Even second degree. We are in UI at roughly the same time. Why haven't they raised that issue in the cabinet? I'm telling you, 3 ranches in Lagos. Matter solved. All this Mietiala, you know, they want to Islamize Nigeria. They are, you know, we will not agree. Everything will end. There will be no need for debates. If anybody matches their cows from the north of Lagos, when nobody sells it, they will match it back. It's as simple as that. And by the way, They also need ranches in the north. So it's not an ethnic competition. They also need ranches there. So that's an easy problem to solve. Yet, we are about to go to civil war over cattle. So, I want to end lastly on the question of ethnic nationalism. What is driving ethnic nationalism in Nigeria? It is frustration that the center has too much power. First, let me make one point. Nnamdi Kanu is not IPOB. In fact, I can hazard something here that he does not have as much. Because a lot of young Igbo men, let me say, I went to school in Women College Umuahia. So a lot of my classmates became spare parts dealers. While the rest of us went to university. The boys working for them expected that because of the apprentice method, that they too would grow. Economic crunch came. The apprentice method does not work like that anymore. Economic crunch came partly because of lack of electricity. I mean, let me give a quick example. One disco services the entire Southeast, the Enugu distribution, one disco. As a result, Aria Market in Aba, which is one of the nation's biggest industrial hubs, spends billions of naira. If they had grid power, their output will quadruple. Unemployment will go up. And if employment will go down. And if there are more jobs and more spending power, there will be less agitation to go your way. And economics can solve these problems. But because a lot of the boys didn't have the opportunity to go to school, the apprentice method has failed, and the government is not engaging them on a developmental level, anybody that waves a flag and says, if we were on our own, we would be better off, they will follow that person. It's a straightforward thing. And a lot of people forget, why was Ojukwu able to declare the governor of Eastern Nigeria in a military? He had executive and so the entire Eastern region. I also went to primary school in Enugu. So for the decade after the war, I was in primary. Well, I did some of my primary education in Lagos, but my primary and secondary education was in the East in the decade after the war. So I know what I'm talking. So if you look at that area, you understand why was Ojukwu able to make that declaration? And don't forget, at that time, he was a history graduate from University of Oxford. So when he saw the historical and conflict circumstances unfolding, he seized the opportunity with rhetoric, stating that if Nigeria cannot protect the Igbo people, he has no choice. That was how he framed it. A civilian cannot do that. Nnamdi Kanu and other person, they can't do that. It's not possible. So they are less of a threat than the government is making out. If Igbo public, the rents of public so quite frankly, you know, they are less of a threat to the future of Nigeria. The main threat to the future of the country is underdevelopment. It's underdevelopment. If Lagos had 20,000 megawatts of power, by the way, Singapore is a city-state, you know, like 1 million people, 12 megawatts of electricity. If Lagos had that 12,000 station, you know, it would be some big thing that people talk about in small lecture rooms. It's all developmental. But I repeat again, it's also historical. It did not start with President Buhari. And let me explain why. In 1960, the population of Nigeria was 45 million. The same as the population of France, 45 million. In 61 years, the population of France has grown by 20 million. The population of Nigeria has grown by 161 million. And the investment in education, power, it has not gone up. What did we think was going to happen? Okay. So, it is a historical problem. But the current ruling elites are also part of the problem. Why? Who knows who was the first governor of northeastern Nigeria? The first military governor of northeastern Nigeria? It's President Buhari. Who was the first governor of Borno State? Same person. The current defense minister was once the military governor of Sokoto State. And so forth like that. I mention them because they are in power now, but the same could apply to Obasanjo or any other person in the entire elite. So guess what? If a lot of those people had invested in primary and secondary education in the 70s and 80s and 90s and had invested in electricity at that time, and the roads had been built, and the investment had been done in health, and so forth, we won't be where we are now. The reason the current government owns the problem is because there can't be two governments in any country at the same time. And if you come into power claiming you are going to solve all the problems and you don't solve it, you carry it on your head. That's the only reason the current government owns the problem. Whoever wins the presidential and governorship election in the majority of the states in 2023 and does two terms, by 2031, if all these problems have not been resolved, what do you think is going to happen in Nigeria? If the country exists by then, I bet you it will be the biggest biblical miracle on this planet. Yes. Why? Look, by 2025, most European countries are not going to make any cars that are powered by petrol or diesel. By 2030, almost all the developed world will stop making cars powered by petrol or diesel. The oil will almost be worthless. If the central government cannot earn that amount of income from oil, it will be penniless, it will be bankrupt. It can't maintain all this military presence in every state. Soldiers will be old for months. Nigeria is not the first place where it's going to happen. Look, if you look across the world, DRC, Somalia, Central African Republic, Afghanistan, the demography can show you the direction. By 2050, Nigeria's population would have doubled to 400 million. At about roughly the same time that the oil will be completely worthless if it still exists. What do we think is going to happen? We have gas, but we are flaring it. The price of cooking gas is going up in a gas-producing country that is importing gas. When they tell you that X million liters of petrol were used in a certain month, and I'm betting you, you know, in Lagos, half the mainland has no light during the day for 8 weeks. Okay. So the petrol usage is going to skyrocket. Yes? Yeah, and we are importing it. So Emefiele says day before yesterday. So he tells us what we know. 40% of the forex in Nigeria is used to import fuel. In a country with 95% power deficit. So as the population grows and the deficit gets wider, more money will be used to import fuel. There's an assumption that Dangote refinery is going to solve that problem. It's an assumption. It will make a dent, but that dent will not be lasting. We are flaring gas, which can be used to power the country. Half the gas used in Europe is sold to them by Russia. Anyway, before our host snatches the mic from me. So, let me just end by saying that the demographic tragedy has many solutions, but there is one key one, which is 12 years of education for all girls in this country and an end to forced child marriage. That is the only way you can drop the population growth. Is that a priority of the president? No. Is that a priority of the state governors? No. The local governments have disappeared completely. So you can see, we say demography is destiny unless you make the investment to change course. If the budget and policy investment is not done, we can tell you where the country will be in 10, 20, 30 years. We can even tell you that the country will not exist at a certain point in time. It's not a question of wishful thinking. It's not a question of naysayers, those mythical figures that Femi Adesina refers to as enemies of the government who don't like the president and don't want him to do well. Who are those people? Because the point must be made that when you proffer solutions to the problem of Nigeria, it is because you want Nigeria to be safe, to prosper, to be better, to be more secure. Nobody owns this country. The country belongs to all of us. If the country fails, we all fail. So why should we allow some people who may not have solutions to call every other person an enemy? And by the way, if it fails, they have nowhere to go. They have nowhere to go. Let me tell you, if you're a public official and you hope to flee Nigeria if it collapses, you need about $5 to $10 million in your back pocket. As corrupt as Nigeria is, maybe there are less than 2,000 people that can actually thief $1 million from the treasury and put it in their back pocket. $1 million will get you nowhere. If you flee to Dubai, you buy a house, you buy it for $300,000. The money is almost gone. You pay for gas, you pay for water, you pay for light, you feed yourself. The remaining will last maybe 5 or 6 years. I've seen ministers, former ministers in Democratic Republic of Congo, driving kabu-kabu in Belgium. Yes, they fled with gold, gold bars in their briefcase. In 6, 8 years, they were driving kabu-kabu in Belgium and France. The number of them that have anywhere to go is very limited. So it's in their enlightened self-interest to ensure that the country is developed. I've seen both sides. Most people know I lived and worked outside Nigeria for about 20 years. I'm a returnee.
We're going to have to go now.
Yeah.
Right.
Aho.
We have to go.
Well, let me just say.
A round of applause.
Join us. Join Aho and I on Public Square next Friday at 4 p.m.
Thank you very much. A round of applause for Rotimi Sankore. A round of applause. Thank you very much. Oh boy.